Tales from the Dark Pool is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
Do you ditch August Falchuk Tales from the Dark Pool? I'm Alice McLaughlin.
And I'm Max Carney.
And we'll be presenting today's programme.
Following on from last week's fantastic show, we can promise you won't be disappointed with this week's offering.
We aim to please.
And please we do.
We start off today with a story from Maryfield College. Over to you, Anna.
The headline said by Anna Crepetta, "It was going to snow for the whole week, but nobody believed it. On Monday it didn't snow, on Tuesday it didn't snow, on Wednesday it didn't snow, and on Thursday it didn't snow. On Friday morning, all the students were going to school as usual. When I reached the school, I went to my locker and I could see that it was snowing outside. I went to my class and I saw through the window that the snow was getting thicker and more of it was coming down. Everyone saw the snow and we were all very excited. At break time, the snow could probably come up to my knees. We thought the teachers would let us go home early because of the snow, but they said that we'd have to stay in school for the rest of the day, as usual. Everyone was very disappointed." The headline said, "This is the biggest storm that has ever happened in Ireland. Students are stuck in their schools and cannot leave because of the storm. It is 6 o'clock and I'm still in school. The storm is so bad that if you stepped outside the school, you would be blown away. I'm really scared. What if I have to spend the night in school?" The headline said, "The storm is still very strong. Do not leave your house. Some schools still have teachers and students in them and they cannot leave. They have to spend 24 hours in their schools. I spent the night in school. It was horrible. It was really cold because the heating wasn't working and there was nowhere to sleep. Some people even slept in their lockers. Unfortunately, I couldn't fit into mine. So I just sat on the freezing, cold floor. I didn't sleep at all. I was awake the whole night. I couldn't believe it. I was stuck in school." The headline said, "The storm is getting much worse. It has already blown away 2 houses and 1 building. Luckily, no one was injured. I have been in school for about 43 hours, 32 minutes and 51 seconds. My second night in the school was a bit better because the heating was working, but now there was another big problem. We were running out of food. Now I'm really, really scared. I hope this will be over soon." The headline said, "We are trying to bring food to those who have none left in their homes, or in some cases, school. Day 4. I haven't eaten anything in 2 whole days, but we have heard that we will get food in the next 24 hours. I'm so hungry. I'm shaking while I'm writing this. If I stay here more than 1 more day, I am seriously going to try to escape." The headline said, "Cars and trucks can barely drive because of the amount of snow and wind making it really hard to deliver food to those who have none. 5 more houses have been seriously damaged, but luckily there is nobody inside them." Day 7. "We have got food, but not near enough to feed the whole school. I have heard that the storm had suddenly stopped. I decided I should escape while it was safe. So, while everyone was sleeping, I went to the door of the school, but it was locked, so I opened a window and jumped out of it. Everything looked much different. Everything was white. I must have made a lot of noise jumping out of the window because there were about 10 more people behind me because they all wanted to escape too. Then I looked out the window. More and more people were coming out." The headline said, "Late last night, the students of one school had made an escape from their school. The storm had stopped and had not come back. It was amazing because all the meteorologists were sure the storm would be back and that it would be 10 times stronger than the last one."
Do you like snow, Alice?
I love snow, Max. Do you?
Yeah, it's my favourite. I hate when they tell you it's going to snow and then it doesn't.
Well, off with the snow boots for another year.
Yeah, I think so. We're heading to your school, Art School LaSalle, for our next story, Alice.
Detente in Dandale by Dallas Swan. Timmy was standing in the hallway of his house in Tulip Court, Dandale. He was standing just outside his living room door, listening to his parents, who were at it again, his dad on his usual soapbox about foreigners and how they got everything. So yelled that snatches of the conversation carried Kiri to the closed door about a house in Primrose Grove done up for them, when we can't even get the council to fix the broken gutters and Steph's room mouldy with damp. Timmy's ma's quieter voice saying, "Someone ran so bad, she met Fatima, the mother of the new family who were from Syria, at the local shop, and sure, she hadn't it easy either, trying to place 4 little ones in a refugee camp at the edge of a war zone." He scarpered into the kitchen when he saw the door handle rattle. His ma was too soft and his da was white. Opening the fridge, he grabbed a half dozen eggs and set off to give his new neighbours a proper welcome. Around the corner, he waited silently, a sullen expression on his face, watching the people go by until he spotted a slight, tired-looking woman in hijab call a small girl into a house, which looked recently painted. Once the door was closed behind the two, Timmy walked closer to that house, tossing an egg from one hand to the other, before taking careful aim, smirking. He listened satisfied to the splat of the eggs and watched as the sticky yellow goo skid down the window panes. Out of the corner of his eye, as pleased with himself, he turned to saunter away. He saw movement at the front door. A boy, roughly his age and size, barreled out the door with rage in his eyes. Timmy sprinted in the direction of Bearcamp Park, followed closely by the boy. Timmy was tackled to the ground and fists rained down upon him. Although he could generally hold his own and boxed in the Oak Club, he couldn't gain the upper hand against his determined opponent, who fought like fury itself, so Timmy was glad when a shadow fell over the two and large hands pulled the boys apart. Wiping a bloody nose and sweat from his forehead, he looked up and knew immediately from the expression on his teacher, Mr. O'Sullivan's face, that a difficult conversation with his ma was coming. The teacher asked the other boy his name, and the reply, Rafiq, came as a whisper. Smiling kindly, Mr. O'Sullivan said to him, "You're in Miss Dunn's fifth, aren't you?" The boy nodded. He'd started the previous week. Timmy stared open-mouthed as the teacher asked him how he was setting in, and became uncomfortable as the boy slowly opened up about how happy he'd been when his family had been picked to resettle here, and how he thought they'd have been safer in Ireland, away from the bombs, the daily fight for food and clean water, the desperate need to keep his little sister safe. How most you people have been nice and welcoming, but every now and then, something like this would happen, and his sisters would be scared, and his mother upset. Red-faced, Timmy squirmed under his teacher's gaze and muttered an apology that he knew was expected of him. Mr. O'Sullivan invited Rafiq to join the Oka Boxing Club, where he helped with the under-12s, and the boy smiled. Then rubbing his bruised cheek, Timmy said with a half-smile, "I can tell you that he has some white hook."
I enjoyed those stories.
Yeah, and they were both so different. Up next are our poems.
Why don't we start with this one, Max? Mother's Love by Vivian Chan, Holy Faith Gloucester. Thank you for caring and loving me. Your warmth, your comfort, your smile. It gleams. You tucked me in bed at 9 o'clock. I was 6 then. I am 16 now. I miss that a lot. We had our first argument. It was pain. However, this is what mothers and daughters do these days. At the end of the day, even though we clashed, a mother and daughter's love will forever last.
I'll go with this poem from Purple Skull Nasson, Ode to the Pictures by Sophie Donnelly. I love movies, they are always great. Having butter popcorn with my mates. Watching something that's sad or fun, I can't watch movies without a buddy. I like going to the cinema too. Some of the language is cruel. Some of the movies make me scared, so I have to hide under my chair. We're heading for our next story.
An Open Letter to the Girl I Once Called My Best Friend by Becky Graham. Dear friend, my earliest memory with you was at the age of 5. The first day of primary school, we both walked through the big wooden door with our hair pulled back in high pigtails. We were filled with excitement and anxiety and sat together playing with the robots, unaware what the next 11 years had in store for us. At the age of 7, we had our first argument while we were in the school bathrooms. I made you cry, and seeing you cry made me cry, so that encounter was shortly resolved and we carried on as good friends. At the age of 10, things changed. I got bullied quite bad, you got your own group of friends in school and I got mine. There was no bad blood between us, we just widened our horizons. At the age of 12, the year prior to that is when we started to get really close again. We had just entered into 6th class, final year of primary school, and which was possibly the most stressful year of our lives. Thinking back on it now, it's easy to laugh at. For me, the bullying continued, and this time it was worse than ever. I still seen you as my best friend, although you became good friends with my bully, but that's okay, you weren't the one doing it. When that school year came to a close, we couldn't have been closer. The summer of 2012 is the year we practically became sisters. We spent every day together in the forest beside your house, pretending we were in the Hunger Games, with our little plastic bows and arrows, and that is a summer I will never forget. At the age of 14, everything became rocky. I was in the middle of moving schools and you blossomed into the confident girl you are today. You found a good group of friends, we soon lost touch, and we didn't talk for 2 months. It felt like I lost a limb when we didn't speak. The next 2 years were good for us. We had our separate friend groups, but not once did we lose touch. You were the sister I never asked for and the sister I would never change. At the age of 16, that's when everything crashed and burned. I lost some good friends because I would always fight tooth and nail for you. That was my choice because I knew you were a great person and you didn't deserve to be talked down. few months later, you went through a hard time with people and I stood by your side like I always have. Then the tables turned and I was going through a lot with my mental health and I needed you. I really needed you. All it took was one night of built up emotions from both parties and poof, you were gone. You stated that you didn't want to speak with me again. Although I had hoped for a better ending, I will respect your wish forever and always. We were meant to be in each other's lives for that period of time. I still check up on your social media the odd time to see how you're doing, and you seem to be doing well. I'm happy about that. I've always wanted the best for you, and that still stands. I would be completely lying if I said I didn't miss you. There are some days I miss you like crazy, but as they say, nothing lasts forever, nothing stays the same, and so it ended just like that. I just need you to know I never thought you were a bad person. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be who I am today. Over the years, we knocked each other down and built one another up. This may be goodbye, but I will thank you eternally for being in my life and giving me some of the best memories I will ever have. Yours truly, an old friend, Becky Graham.
That letter is interesting. It shows an alternative way of telling a story.
We'll go to school Katrina for Rena Kni Dunaku's take on the poem Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost.
Promises to Keep by Rena Kni Dunaku. Robert stood deep in the forest, watching the snow as if he was waiting for it to fill up the world. His horse stayed very close to him, almost as if he was protecting him. This wasn't just a normal winter's evening. This was the darkest day of the year. As Robert walked through the forest, he went to the darkest place in his mind. He knew he had promises to keep, but all he could think of was, if only I could sleep. The horse was plodding through the forest with difficulty now because the snow was becoming so deep. His horse must have thought it was strange, being in the forest when it was so dark and nothing near. It was so dark and cold, Robert was beginning to lose feeling in the tips of his fingers. That moment was when Robert remembered the large, roaring fire that was burning at home. Then, the thought of the next day came to him. He got a sharp, sick feeling in his stomach just thinking about it. The man had told him if he didn't have the money, things wouldn't end very well. Robert had most of the money, but was still a little short. His heart beating fiercely in his chest, he thought of his life yet not lived. He thought of the wonder of tomorrow, whilst also knowing he had devils to face down. Should he keep going or return to his demons? Life is short for some, perhaps because they didn't want to live the rest of it, or because they had made bad choices along the way. Robert decided he did not want to be one of those people. He wanted to see everything he could and live a life as full and as long as possible. So he jumped on his horse and shouted, "To the village, we have things to do, people to see, and we won't sleep until we've lived life to the fullest."
It goes to show how personal poetry can be.
In our time, it almost always is. Although in the olden days, poems were commissioned and written for money. Would you call that fake emotion?
I'd call it a nice job if the money was good.
Bring it on. Our next poem will be read by its composer.
Conquered Fears, a narrative poem by Craig Kearney. Today is the day that I go on a plane. It's my biggest fear, so I thought, this is insane. I kept telling myself it's all just a dream. Trying to wake up, I wasn't really keen. When I stepped foot inside my biggest fear, I tried my hardest not to shed a tear. My mother hugged me and said, "Are you alright, son?" I said, "Yeah, mum, you know, this should be fun." Just saying that to get my mum off my back, drifting away, lying on my rucksack. Out of nowhere, the plane started to take off, holding my mother's cardigan nice and soft. In a few seconds, we were in the sky. I looked out the window. Wow, that's really high. As it went on and on, my fear started to go. Then I thought, this isn't bad, you know. Looking out the window and seeing the pilots from the rear, I said to myself, this truly is a conquered fear.
Some stories up next.
We're off to your school, Max Mount Temple, for a very cautionary tale.
Asking for It by Amy Nolan. With each laugh, I cut deeper and deeper into my self-esteem. My so-called best friends had hurt me more than any boy ever has. The last time I checked, it shouldn't be like that. I didn't mean for it to happen, but then again, I was asking for it. I was freezing, all these bright lights of camcorders shining in my face. People crowded around me laughing and pointing at me. I was so confused. 3:30 p.m. on a Saturday, the girls and I were getting ready to go out to do the annual party connected with our school. We were all really excited to go. Not that the party was going to be good or anything, they were always awful. It was just an excuse for us to get dressed up in skimpy clothes so the boys that we fancy would finally notice us, and so that we could feel the pressure of having to drink the drinks we hate until we feel ill and are throwing our guts up and can no longer even stand, all just to look cool and, well, fit in, really. John was going to be there tonight. I've had a major crush on him since I was in primary school. Every time I see him, I can hear my heart throb through my ears. I needed to look good tonight and let him know how available and open I was, just so he will finally notice me and, after all these years, know my name. Tonight was the night to be noticed. I throw on my new dress that I bought two sizes too small for me, just so it could be as short and as tight as possible. I cake on a pile of makeup, enough to make me change how my face looks completely. That's how I knew I had enough on. One last look in the mirror and I realise how flat-chested I am compared to Jenny and Steph. But nothing a push-up bra can fix. With my boobs pushed up to my chin, John has to notice me now, no matter how uncomfortable and sore it may feel. We get a taxi and arrive at the party, and for once I'm feeling good about myself. I walk in, feeling ready to be noticed. When I walk into the party, I have the girls on either side of me, and we do the typical look around and check everyone and everything out kind of routine, and then we continue into the party. It's been about 40 minutes now, and still no sign of John. The two girls are off in the corner kissing some guys they've never seen before and will regret in the morning, so for now I'm left sitting at a table alone pretending to sip on some weird liquor I honestly hate. I'm staring at and watching everybody as they walk by me, noticing all the things about them. I see right through them, you see. Everyone here is so fake, including myself. This wasn't me, all these short dresses and fake boobs, none of it was me. But I knew this was the type of girl that John would be looking for, so it was all worth it in the end. Not even realising that through my thoughts and boredom I was now on my 7th shot of vodka. I didn't even realise my anxiety took over and took control of my hands and head because I thought the people were starting to notice that I had been holding the same glass and the same drink for the last hour and a half. I had knocked that vodka back like it was me getting my first bit of water after being trapped in the Sahara Desert for 6 days. At this stage, the drink had hit me way harder than I had put out for. My legs had gone numb. My knees were trembling as I tried to put pressure on them, yet I continued to drink. I can feel my eyes starting to droop. I could feel myself slowly slip into a drunken coma. My eyesight was extremely blurry. I could no longer make out the people's faces anymore, until I saw a blur from a distance. A blur of a face I would recognise drunk or sober. It was John. My heart sank into my empty shot glass. It was time for me to be noticed. I gather up my courage and stumble over towards him. When the struggle of walking over to him was over, I was now standing the closest I had ever stood to him. His back was turned. I went to go tap his shoulder when his head turned in sideways. All of a sudden, this big blur I was witnessing became a crystal clear image. John and my best friend, Jenny, were now kissing. Each lip touch felt like a stab in my heart. I panicked. Shot after shot and drowning my sorrows, staring through a crowded room of people, I could only see two, Jenny and John, kissing, a sight I never wanted to see. 3 hours into the party now, they've moved from where they were originally kissing to upstairs. A drunken mess at this stage, sobbing to myself. Thoughts deeper than the Pacific Ocean running faster than Usain Bolt through my mind. Is it because my hair is too short, my dress is too long, or that my bottom teeth are crooked? Why her and not me? That's all I wanted to know. How do I prove to him that I'm better than her? An hour later, the two of them stroll down the stairs holding hands, all loved up, not a care in the world. Two can play that game. I've realised I deserve to be happy. I gathered my things, fixed my lipstick, brushed my hair and scooped up my boobs, and then I stood up straight, well, as straight as a person this intoxicated could possibly stand, and grabbed the first guy I saw and started kissing him. He was gobbed. I was kissing him in a fake but passionate way in the hope that I would catch John's attention. The kiss felt like the longest and most forced kiss in history to me. My mind suddenly begins to blank. The floor lifts from beneath my feet. I fell and hit the floor harder than I had ever fell for John. I had passed out. All I recall is being thrown over a guy's shoulder I was kissing and being carried upstairs. I was then laid down on the bed and stripped from my clothes and my self-worth. At this very moment I realised that this was a bad idea and something bad was about to happen and there was nothing I could do. I had no control over my body, but he did. I was a dead weight. As his hand slipped up my thigh, I began to regret wearing this short, short dress. A tear rolled down the side of my face and my eyes eventually closed shut as I passed out again. My last sight and feeling I recall was the walls closing in on me and my heart beat through my ears, like what used to happen with John. I was freezing. All of these lights and camcorders shining on my face, people crowded around me laughing and pointing. I was so confused. I sat up and looked all around. All of my clothes were gone, along with my dignity. Three boys in the bed beside me, also naked, but only difference with them was that they were laughing and I was crying. I got out of bed and looked in the mirror to find I had writing all over my naked and revealed body that wrote slut and other nasty things about me that I had no idea what about. I guess they were true though, I mean, look at me. Everybody else was, even Jenny and John holding hands. Several videos of me were posted in the bed with those boys that night with writing all over me. They went viral within days. Everyone was talking about it and I couldn't go to school or show my face in public without getting abuse shouted at me. The damage was done. I felt so violated and embarrassed. But then again, at the end of the day, who else was there to blame? In an outfit a skimpy like that and me looking like that going to that party, I was only asking for it.
Some stories are thought-provoking, and asking for it definitely falls into that category.
That takes us nicely to our last batch of thought-provoking poems.
How about this one from St. Aidan's CBS? Happiness Sonnet by Milan Benoy. There came today a shower of delight, which pitter-pattered on my window pane. Without a second thought, my mind took flight. Outside I ran, embracing April's rain. How sweet it scent, my cell was filled with cheerfulness, for I was truly living in the now. Upon my lips I tasted earth's gladness, as spring's refreshment fell upon my brow. I paused nearby my ornamental hair, inhaling deeply, taking in every sound. The world was singing, fragrance filled the air, then I began to spin around. Oh, how I wished to feel that way again, so alive and hope-filled, standing in the rain.
That poem is a real breath of fresh air. What do you think of this one from Holy Faith Gloucester Max? The Sunrise by Robin Poole. The sun rose up into the sky and red shadows were painted across the town. The sun's dim light lit the quiet streets, not a soul around, nothing to be heard. The sun grew brighter as the streets grew louder. People began to fill the streets, selling all they owned at the market stalls, always disappointed at their profits. As the final market closed, the sun grew sad, slowly getting darker and darker. The streets became peaceful once again while the sun went back to sleep.
I think that's the perfect end to today's excellent selection of poems.
Ladies and gentlemen, as always, our last story of the day is our feature story. It is written by Ava Murphy, a pupil at Manor House School, Raheny.
The headline said, by Ava Murphy. Winter streets are clouded by smoke from the cigars of old men in bowler hats. The pavements glitter with frost. Newspapers hang about on old park benches and rot with the brown foliage that autumn left behind. All for nothing, the headline said. But newspapers often lie. Mrs. Fisher called a council meeting to discuss the sudden dissolution of the local newspaper company. She, along with various other town council heads, expressed their opinions regarding the matter. When they began with the statistics, I became totally disinterested. Truthfully, I wasn't too concerned, as my empathy was not in play, and in a town like ours, there is no shortage of jobs. Also, this newspaper company were well-known liars. They tended to use bias and often invented their own versions of the truth to heighten dramatic effect in order to improve their sales. It happened in autumn. The town itself had never been so bustling, and crowds thick as treacle filtered in and out of shops. Music swelled in corners of the streets and danced out of nightclubs late at night. The walls turned to rainbows of spray paint, and bus shelters shattered all over the ground like stardust. The people responsible for this vandalism were but teenagers in search of thrills. Thrills at no cost to them, but at huge cost to the council. Their stupidity manifested itself one night. Four boys and three girls. They decided to spray paint several high-end security cameras white. It must have seemed like an obviously good idea to them at the time. However, technology proves itself to confuse even the current generation, and as a result of improved technology, these youngsters sprayed the wrong part of the camera, where they imagined the lens to be, and missed the lens completely. Now you see me, the headline said in the local newspaper, describing how the teenagers misjudged the placement of the security camera's lens. Their version of the story, a very exaggerated version of what in truth happened. The next day, the office workers paced steadily into work to find lovely white cameras. At the same time, the teenagers found themselves in court. Marcia, one of the three girls, her father was a lawyer. He represented the seven youths. He proved himself to be a very good lawyer. They left the court that day with a fine and community service. Marcia's father tried for an appeal in vain. He was, however, a persistent man, a man with connections. He made a few phone calls. Orange is the new black, the headline said in the local newspaper, followed with the picture of the seven teens in their orange vests, practicing community service. It included a statement from one of the teenagers, which they tweaked, as newspapers do. Add some hardy aristocrats with spare time to this equation, and you have a problem. They claimed to be friends of Marcia's father. These prosperous women and men had all the time in the world, along with an abundant source of money. It is accurate to say they spend their money in equal measures to their time. They call each other by their second names and wear smart suits daily. They were those type of people that tried to achieve an image. they made a habit of always carrying briefcases, though they were often empty. To stimulate themselves, they began to notice things the average person wouldn't notice. They began to use their knowledge. They had nothing to lose, only money, and as I said, it was in abundance. So they started, as a group, in the state-of-the-art office they rented out. They took the reputation of the local newspaper in their hands, and with great bliss, destroyed it. These aristocrats, along with Marcia's father, worked day and night building up evidence. They got in touch with well-known film agencies and had a strong case against the local newspaper. 3 weeks later, on a beautiful morning, to the rhythm of the singing birds, they filed their case. Unauthorised copyright of film titles and headlines. Deceiving the public. The local newspaper, the only local newspaper, found themselves in a rather awkward situation, for they did not have money to lose. They found themselves in court with an average lawyer, their opposition being a group of well-to-do men and women. They could not deny any of the opposition's accusations, as these accusations were, in fact, all true. Suddenly, as quickly as a gavel could hit a small sound block, the local newspaper was bankrupt. There was no change in the air that evening. The birds sang just as cheerfully as ever, and tires still made marks on the road. The company issued one last newspaper with the news of their closure. All for nothing, the headline said, explaining how one little mistake was the difference between a thriving news agency and bankruptcy. This was not completely true. This particular edition had a huge readership. It became almost a collector's item. Newspapers were snatched up from places all over the town like sweets falling from a piñata. It caused people to talk more, as people with traditional minds trust and enjoy a rumour more than a television broadcast. Council meetings had never been so in fashion. It won't be long, I'm sure, until the aristocrats start a newspaper company of their own. Winter streets are just as clouded by smoke from the cigars of old men in bowler hats. The pavements glitter with frost and shattered glass. Music still swells in the corners of streets and dances out of nightclubs late at night. Yet, you miss the newspapers that hang about on old park benches when they're gone. All for nothing, the headline said. But newspapers often lie.
What a brilliant end to a brilliant day.
Yes, indeed, but unfortunately that's all we have for you today. I hope we got to your story or poem. If we didn't, there's always next week.
Don't forget to check out the Tales from the Dark Pool Facebook page and the Near FM website for full details on the series and a podcast of this programme and all programmes broadcast on Near FM.
We hope you enjoyed today's show.
And will join us at the same time next week on Tales from the Dark Pool, broadcast here on Near FM.
Today's Tales from the Dark Pill programme was produced by Enda M. Roach and is a Perlman Media production for Near FM.
So, for myself, Max Carney.
And myself, Alice McLaughlin.
Until next week, Slán go fóill.